officer's training. Something else. Something more. He had humored her, sitting through night classes when he could, joining the army in 41, telling her, to her consternation, that there wasn't much he wanted in the long run, that when he got right down to it, he was happy enough with what he had. Now, on these mornings after he and Billy had returned from their hiatus on Long Island, she watched him get ready to go to the office, forever ordinary as far as she was concerned, forever out of uniform and in suits that she thought could have been better tailored, although his shirt was well-pressed. She watched him eat his breakfast, adjust his hat in the mirror in the hall, lift his briefcase and his umbrella, and head out to the bus that would take him to the subway, that would take him to the office, precisely as she knew he would be doing for the next 40 years, and she would not be able to disguise her regret. He could see it in her face as she watched from the front window. Good-natured son, loyal employee like his father, one of the so many million. Just one more. Holtzman would come down the stairs as Dennis went out the door, and he'd always take his time saying good morning to her and putting on his hat and his coat, making sure that Dennis was a good 3 or 4 blocks ahead of him before he himself set out to pick up his morning paper at the corner store. If the bus was late, Dennis would see him there, tossing a nickel into the cigar box where Dennis had just tossed his. They'd both raise their respective copies, intent on 3-inch headlines and at the ready with an expression of complete surprise. "Well, hello, didn't see you," should either one of them acknowledge the other, which of course neither one of them ever did. Back at the mansion, Dennis knew, his mother would have the eggs boiling and a plate of sliced bread set out on the stove. When Holtzman came in, he would pin each piece to a long fork and toast it perfectly over the open flame of the gas burner. He did the same for Dennis on weekends. Dennis imagined that it had been the bane of the man's long bachelorhood, having no one for whom to demonstrate this technique. "And you ask me," my father said, "if I think Danny Lynch is a lonely soul." Every morning, Holtzman and his mother sat catty-corner at the old kitchen table where Dennis had once done his homework, where his father had once sat, recited, sung, put his forehead to the bare wood when the night had been long and the sun too quick to rise. Sitting catty-corner, Holtzman and his mother talked about money, investments they had made, bills that were owed, profit from the store, and the wholesale price of shoes. Every once in a while, Holtzman would reach under the table to pat her knee, or she would touch his hand, still talking, so that anyone watching from behind the kitchen's thick-paned windows would think they'd been pledging love for half an hour over their cooling eggs, not determining the limits of their inventory. She was a continual marvel to Holtzman, as far as Dennis could see, this tiny woman who had arrived so unexpectedly into his late middle age. She seemed to think of him as the embodiment of good sense, practicality, relief, the soundest investment she had ever made. When they had eaten, he would take the paper and a second cup of coffee into the living room, or more discreetly, up the stairs to the hall bath, while she did the dishes and then went down to the basement to start the wash. It always gave her enormous pleasure to consider how her marriage had brought her not merely a house, but a basement all her own. It struck her as a great luxury not to have to maneuver around the baby carriages and footlockers and the deplorable armchairs of a dozen neighbors, but to be able to sail unimpeded from stair to washtub to clothesline and ironing board, which she had set up in April of 1945 when she first moved in, and would never be required to take down again. Of course, Holtzman's basement wasn't empty, but what it contained was mostly hers, her footlockers and garment bags and end tables. As she had said in her letters to Dennis overseas, Holtzman was terribly reasonable about her things, insisting that since she was the one giving up her apartment, her home, he'd called it, then she should not give up her furniture as well. It hadn't taken much to accommodate it all. His house had 3 times as many rooms as the apartment, and what became redundant, his dining room and kitchen set, for instance, a number of lamps, a bed, he had generously allowed her to offer to her late husband's relatives. With the war ending, there were plenty of takers among the various cousins, even among those who hadn't found homes of their own yet, or even spouses. Holtzman's old kitchen chairs, for instance, ended up in Mary Lynch's bedroom in Astoria, piled in a column against the wall for what must have been at least 3 years, maybe four. A monument to hope, her father, Uncle Jim, used to call it, until Mary met Jack Casey just in time. She was nearing 30 herself. And the chairs became kitchen chairs once again. For Dennis's mother, these excess bits of furniture not only established her new role as benefactress, she who for so long, throughout her first marriage, in fact, and well before, had been supplicant. They also paid off a debt. She was, to a great extent, beholden to her first husband's people, who had supported her so generously during the period of his illness and her widowhood, and especially in the years after Dennis joined the service. And throughout those years, try as she might to pay them back, or even to temper their generosity with the insistence that her widow's pension was sufficient, her needs few, they would only hold up their hands and respond with some long and often exaggerated tale of what selfless and big-hearted miracle her Daniel had once done for them. Tales that would more often than not end with tears and a "God bless his soul," or a "we won't see another one like him again." Until she, Sheila Lynch, the impoverished widow with the soldier son, would find herself brewing them a cup of tea or pouring out a drop of vermouth or putting an arm across their shoulders to whisper, "They're there." My father would say this much for his mother. She never distanced herself from her first husband's family after she married Holtzman, as much as she might have liked to. In the basement, she would plug in the iron and pause to see if the lights would flicker. They did, something to ask Dennis about. She'd fill her sprinkler bottle at the sink and take the shirts from the line and iron them, her husband's and then her son's. He had been, without question, holy father to the entire clan, her Daniel. 44 years old when she met him, with a shock of dark hair falling down into his homely face. Holy father to the world, if it had let him. The story went that she had been living at the time off Nostrand Avenue in a small and airless apartment that belonged to her great-uncle Robert and Auntie Eileen, his dour wife. They didn't want her there. She had seen the man bite his lip when she reached for a second piece of toast and grip the table, as if he might at any minute leap up to stay her hand if she poured more than a splash of milk into her oatmeal. But their only son had left for Europe, and news of his empty bedroom reached Washington Heights, where she had been living with another younger aunt and uncle, sharing a bed with an 8-year-old cousin, a boy with limbs of lead and the odor of a wet overcoat. Auntie Eileen had resisted the idea of some 16-year-old girl occupying her son's room, drilling the scent of her hair into his pillow, scattering undergarments, bleeding onto his mattress. She thought of everything, that woman, and relented only after she swore never to dress or undress in the son's room. She was instead directed to leave her bags in a corner of the pantry and to change her clothes there before her uncle was up in the morning and after he went to bed at night. This she did willingly, her cousin's wide feather bed all to herself was such a luxury, and seeing her up and all ready for school just as he was shuffling into the kitchen must have given her uncle an inspiration. She wasn't there long when he announced that he'd found a little something for her to do. A couple he knew, countrymen of his, had a bakery on DeKalb, and since the wife was troubled with back problems, they could use a girl to come in first thing in the morning to set out the breads and the cakes. He never said how much she would be paid, and she understood without asking that whatever money she made would go straight to him. Her uncle knew that it had been her parents' dying wish that she stay in school, and he himself had enrolled her at manual training the very day she left Washington Heights. But the morning job was a nice way of offsetting what the care of her would cost him, without compromising whatever reluctant pact he had made with the dead. The day before she was about to start, she went by the place after school. Only the baker's wife, Mrs. Dixon, was there, but she was rosy-cheeked and merry, and cried out when she saw her, "Oh, but you're a wee little thing." It was like a fairy tale that first morning. The streets were wet and dark, full of reflections. Somewhat ominous, sure, so early in the morning that it was nighttime still, but also full of promise, adventure. When she came into the empty shop, it was warm and dimly lit, and full of the scent of baking bread. All the light came from the back where the ovens were, but there was enough light to see by, and she found the cap and coat she was to wear folded neatly on the counter. She thought of the elves and the shoemaker. She covered her hair and slipped into the smock. Yesterday, when Mrs. Dixon had showed it to her, it had buckled over her shoes. Now, it was hemmed to just the right length, 10 inches above her ankles. Hesitantly, but ready to begin, she peered into the light of the back room. She felt the heat of the stove like a warm hand on her face, and then she saw the baker sitting on a stool beside one of the wooden tables. His shoes and his pant legs beneath his apron were covered with flour, his shoulders were slumped, and he had his hand around the glass that was resting on the table beside him. He was a dark-haired man with black brows and a broad, flushed face. He looked up at her from under those brows and then waved his free hand and said, not unkindly, "Well, come in, come in. I'm not going to bite you." She stepped in. The wooden floor seemed soft, and it, too, was covered with flour. On another huge table just opposite the great cast-iron stove, there was a sheet of scones not yet baked, and a wicker basket full of small brown loaves.
"My wife showed you what to do?" he asked.
She nodded.
"Yes," she said, but there was little voice in it.
She had to rise up on her tiptoes to get a good grip on the basket, and then nearly crashed into the doorframe as she carried it out, feeling him watching her. When she returned, he was standing, slipping the sheet of scones into the oven. Another sheet, golden brown and redolent, was on the wide table. He looked at her over his shoulder as he closed the oven door.
"You're a little bit of a thing, aren't you?"
he said pleasantly, friendlier than he'd been before. They were standing together in the narrow space between the oven and the table, and the empty basket in her hands made the space seem narrower still. He suddenly reached out and pulled at her earlobe with a floured hand.
"A wee thing," he said.
He wasn't much bigger, really only a head taller, than she, but his chest was broad and had begun to press against the basket and her arm. He tugged at a strand of hair near her temple, poked at her cap. By now she could smell the drink on his breath, but didn't know enough then to recognize it for what it was.
"A wee baby doll in her dress," he said, and pulled at the collar of her smock.
He chucked her chin. She only grinned, blushing. He was old enough and she was young enough. She believed he was playing with her the way you would play with a young child, admiring her, making friends. He told her to take the empty basket to the kneading table. She was grateful to be free of that tight space, free of his attention. She could feel her face begin to cool. He was on her so fast she thought for a moment that the lights had gone out. He had her head in the crook of his arm, and so startled her that he caught her opened mouth with his own, and she could hear the click of their front teeth. It was not a kiss, it was all teeth and wet bone, and she could feel the low laughter in his chest in the moment before he released her. Laughing still, he turned casually back to his work. Out in the shop, she dropped half the scones and had to wipe them off on her new smock. She rubbed her mouth with the sleeve. In the back, he had begun to sing. Pieces of folk songs and of lullabies. Some of the songs her own father had sung. A beautiful maiden much loved by a young boy going off to war. A sea captain bound for his last voyage, kissing his wife at the garden gate. When she returned with the empty tray, he merely glanced at her over his shoulder, his mouth now gently shaped for his tune. He had a good voice, soft and sweet, although the words gave him some trouble. When she left the shop that morning, the sun was up, and the street, newly washed, smelled like the coming spring. The world was populated again, with people whom she might, in time, come to know. On the way, she met a plump girl from her class, Alma, who was delighted to accept the bag of warm scones Mrs. Dixon had pressed upon her as she left the store.
"I don't like them," she told Alma by way of explanation. "Never did."
She lived the next year not so much in a nightmare as on the verge of one, because there was no telling. Days would go by and he wouldn't touch her. Then there would be a jolly morning. He might be singing, icing a cake,
and in an instant he'd have her by the throat. Or worse, she'd come in to find him morose, mostly silent, hardly moving from his stool. She'd keep her eye on him then, avoid him whenever she could, even taking things out of the oven herself, which Mrs. Dixon told her never to do, so she would not have to disturb him. Sometimes it would work, and she'd slip out of the shop at 8 o'clock like a fish released to a stream. Sometimes he would raise his heavy brows and say her name again and again. Sheila, Sheila, wagging his great head until she had come close enough for him to grab her wrist or her skirt or her sleeve and aim his murderous yellow teeth toward her breasts. Sometimes he would just appear behind her and take hold of her hair. He'd back her up against the alley door or press her into a wall. A filthy, dirty man, she said, telling the tale. This would have been in their kitchen in Woodside at the crumb-scattered table, just Dennis and his mother alone in the apartment now. Dennis just beginning his career with Con Ed. What was lucky, she'd said, was that the man was a drinker, or else who knows how far he might have gone. A man can't, you know, she'd said. After too many drinks. I don't suppose your father ever told you. Child that she still was, she began devising rituals that might protect her, or at least predict for her how the morning would run. If she could walk from her uncle's building to the bakery without lifting her eyes, he wouldn't touch her that day. If she saw the street sweeper's cart at the corner, he would. Then there came a morning when she handed Alma her bag of treats, and Alma said, "I'm going to miss these." She had a job at an office building downtown. Her father had put her onto it. She was leaving school at the end of the week. 2 hours later, Sheila herself sat in front of the man Alma had described. He was a balding man with a mustache and a bow tie and an old-fashioned high collar. The cubicle he met her in was small, with one window wide open to let in the breeze. He began by talking a little about the war and the patriotism of American youth, and asked if anyone near and dear to her was over there, carrying her picture. She said no. Had she leaned any farther back in her chair, she'd have been out the window herself. He gave her the job, no doubt because he thought she was a serious and steady young woman bound for spinsterhood. She didn't go back to the bakery. She didn't finish school, either. She knew this part of it would have been a blow to her parents, who had been mad for education. But in the nearly half-dozen years since they had both, one within 4 months of the other, taken sick and died, her mother not taking nearly so long to go about it, hurrying to join him, some had said, she had received very little aid from them, and even less comfort. At 12, she had imagined 2 hovering angels to guide her for the rest of her life, but she had since lived too many desolate nights in rooms where she was not wanted and did not belong, eaten too many bitter meals, every bite and every sip counted and resented. She had tasted Mr. Dixon's breath, smelled the sharp, lingering scent of his saliva on her cheeks and lips even as she bowed her head and asked them to deliver her. Had they lived, she knew, they would have been sorry to see her leaving school. But they hadn't, and that was all. "That was all," she had said in the tiny kitchen in Woodside, in the middle of her dark fairy tale. Something else his God-fearing, ghost-hearing, saint-loving father hadn't told him. They hadn't lived, and that was all. Her uncle frowned to disappoint his friend, but since she would turn her salary over to him, he was reconciled. On a Monday morning, she joined Alma on the train. She figured she had pulled herself from the edge of hell, and even if the job proved dull, which it did, and Alma, without her daily bakery bribe, disloyal, she did not. There was the luxury, anyway, of this gray purgatory. At Borough Hall, she followed her friend's wide rump up the steps of the streetcar. Eclipsed by the great expanse of black gabardine that was Alma, she heard his brogue first, that loud and laughing voice. And then, climbing aboard, she got her first glimpse of his homely, happy face. When she went upstairs again, Holtzman would have opened the window and sprayed the bathroom with cologne. She'd give him his pressed shirt and hang Dennis's in his room. Another luxury her marriage had brought her, closets to store things in, closets to step into. When Holtzman was dressed and ready, he would find her again and kiss her goodbye. He would always have the newspaper under his arm and without fail, it seemed, a shoebox. He was daily finding new shoes for her in her size. It was, after all, the way he'd wooed her. And more often than not, she found them lacking. A harder sell as a wife, my father said, than she had ever been as a customer. Holtzman took the bus to the store in those days, and as soon as he was gone, she would put on a house dress and wrap her hair in a duster, and clean. You have to understand what the house meant to her, a woman who had spent so much of her adolescence as a guest in already overburdened households, sleeping on the edge of beds, keeping her clothes in a box out in the pantry or the hallway, who had spent her first married life in one- and two-bedroom apartments that also served as permanent way stations for an endless string of penniless Irish immigrants. He was a character. This was the word the passengers on the trolley said to one another, or so the story went. Men in straw hats and bowlers in those days, women in their dark office costumes. They'd lean toward one another in their seats, smiling over something he'd said, or more likely cried out. Isn't he a character? Is it spats you're wearing today, Mr. Ellsworth? He might ask the frail old gentleman who had just cautiously seated himself. Aren't they handsome? Now, if you die in those today, you know, the undertaker will be dancing in them tomorrow. Mr. Ellsworth would grin. Oh, I won't die today, Mr. Lynch. The passengers all around them smiling in anticipation as if they were watching a couple of vaudeville comedians. Not until I hear what happened to Paddy at Asbury Park. Daniel would lift his cap and brush back that shock of thick dark hair. Jesus, he'd tell them. There's a tale. He was a legend, at least in that part of Brooklyn at that hour of the day. He talked constantly, pointing out as he did some fellow on the street, or a cop he knew, or a building that was a part of another story. Eventually, the talk always came around to Paddy. And sometimes Paddy was a brother, and sometimes Paddy was a cousin, and sometimes an uncle or a friend. Paddy making the crossing, and Paddy on Ellis Island, and Paddy taking the wrong train to Pittsburgh or Vermont. Paddy's in Philadelphia. My brother put him onto a job there, making cream cheese of all things. He's staying with some relations who have a cat as big as a suitcase, and when Paddy comes home the first day at the factory, he smells for all the world like a 6-foot bottle of milk. There were passengers who waited on the street, letting other cars pass in order to board Daniel's. Others who timed their commutes simply to be able to ride with him. Sheila began to do the same. Not because she cared for his stories. Too many of them, she said, were either impossible or absurd. And not because he called her by name or tickled her fancy each day with some sly running joke. Old Mr. Ellsworth had made it through another night, and sweet-faced and asthmatic Mrs. Timoney, always huffing and puffing, was being sought by the police, and Saul, a hunchbacked office boy, was a colonel just back from the front. Even Fat Alma, who carried an umbrella no matter the weather, was a prognosticator of disastrous storms. Tornadoes today, miss? Is there a typhoon in the air? She waited for his car, because she silenced him. Her life had slipped into its tedious routine, out of the son's bed by dawn, and always with a shudder to recall what other early mornings had brought, and a quick wash and dress in the tiny space of the pantry. Breakfast for herself and her aunt and uncle, and then the washing up, the walk to the train. In the mailroom, she was corralled like a horse with an unending number of envelopes and packages. 20 minutes for lunch, 10 for coffee. One of the many million. Just one more. But once or twice a day, if she caught the right car, she was a rarity, a sphinx. She was watched for. She silenced him. He who had something to say to everyone could only stammer and blush as she walked by, could only say, "Good day, miss," and not even that if she looked him straight in the eye. The other passengers saw it, even Alma saw it, and the initial surprise it had engendered gave way to curiosity, and then a sympathetic awe. He was in love with her, they whispered, had to be, and she giving him nothing in return, not even the time of day. In that odd moment of silence that always followed her boarding, she was the one who had everybody's attention, not Daniel. And that was what she couldn't get enough of after the life she had led. To be noticed, to be singled out, to be recognized as someone unlike any other. It was midsummer the morning his car pulled in, but he was not on it. There was a general backing down the stairs. "Where's Daniel?" someone asked, debating whether to go forward or to wait.
"Out today,"
the strange man said. Resignedly, they boarded. And just as they were seated, Daniel himself swung up into the car, looking ridiculous in a brown suit and a straw hat with a green and yellow striped band. He was flushed and breathless. The other passengers greeted him as if he were a returning hero, but he ducked his head shyly and took the seat just behind her.
"Any hurricanes?"
he asked Alma, but with unutterable sadness, as if he had just been gutted of all humor and all resolve. She giggled and squeezed her arms together, turning in her seat to see him.
"Not yet," she said.
His brown eyes were on the back of Sheila's neck.
"Your day on the town, Daniel?" a passenger asked him.
"You might say that."
But nothing more for them, not this day.
"Out and about with Patty?"
a woman asked from across the aisle.
"No," he said softly. "Not me."
When she got up to leave the car, she turned to him. What a lost soul he seemed in his brown suit and his good hat. She saw that whatever it was he had imagined he would say or do had been washed out of all possibility, just the way the color was washed from his face. The next day he was himself again, although he reddened even before she passed him. His cousin Patty was getting married, he told them, lucky man, to a redhead, no less. Not very big, but with a fine face. He was having some trouble with the ring, however. He's thick, is Patty, with the size of the ring, and so he took a 2-cent washer and a ham bone down to the jeweler. Everyone's eyes going to her as he spoke, she watching only the street, a girl unlike any other. In September, the women in the office were warned that they might have to make way for the returning veterans. On a Friday night in October, she came home to find Mr. and Mrs. Dixon in the living room, him with his suit on and his hair slicked back as if he had come courting, her heavier than she had been, her moon face hanging wider and lower than usual over its cushion of soft chins. When she went into her bedroom to take off her hat, she saw that the mattress had been stripped, the pillows and blankets heaped across the opened window. The sun was coming home. On Auntie Eileen's yellow face, joy looked like a stomach disorder, and she would have to find another place for herself. The Dixons had a little extra room in their apartment above the store. Tiny, Mrs. Dixon said, but neat. And with a child on the way, Mrs. Dixon touched her wide waist, they would need someone to help them full time. So it could all work out very nicely. Over dinner, Mr. Dixon moved his black little teeth to say, "You're not eating." And Uncle Robert laughed and said she usually ate plenty. On the trolley car that Monday, she followed Alma's swaying backside up the stairs and then said,
"Hello, Daniel," with an angel's smile. "How are you today?"
There was a pause, she was certain, and then from somewhere in the car, a smattering of applause.
"I'm fine, thank you, miss," Daniel said. "It's a lovely day, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is,"
she told him, although it was cold and damp with a spitting rain.
"Just lovely."
Passing old Mr. Ellsworth in his seat, she swore she saw a tear in his eye. Not dead yet, after all. The rest of the story went that on her second morning as a young bride, she stepped out of her bedroom and found two characters asleep on the living room floor. They wore mismatched parts of dirty suits and used their battered satchels for pillows, and they slept with their hands tucked between their thighs, like hobos. There was a warm barnyard odor in the air. She stepped back, startled, and bumped into Daniel.
"Your dad,"
she said in the kitchen in Woodside when the word alone was enough to make Dennis's heart ache with his own loss, who was right behind her.
Who were they?
She had asked. Patty was the answer. She claimed she never again had the place all to herself, and would not have it to herself until Dennis went off to Fort Dix. She never had his attention all to herself again either, my father said. Not even when he was dying, and the parade of Paddies in and out of the ward where he lay so impressed all the nurses that one of them had asked, or so he'd heard told, "Is he a politician?" But now she had this sturdy house, all brick, 3 bedrooms upstairs, and a full basement, and foot after foot of baseboard to dust and floor to polish. A tiny garage out back, a small yard with a tree, a front hedge. You could say it was the influence of her tidy German husband that transformed her from the indifferent housekeeper she had been while Dennis was growing up into the cleaning dervish she became as Mrs. Holtzman. But the more likely explanation seemed to be that cleaning Holtzman's house was her way of pacing off her acreage, tallying her assets, running her hands through her pile of gold doubloons. There was a laundry list of reasons why she had married again, and not one of them had anything to do with love. But with enough space, when you came right down to it, enough baseboard and yard and empty room, enough heat in the winter and sufficient windows to open for a cross breeze in summer, love was an easy thing to do without. For some of us, anyway. In those days, Billy was at Irving Place, too, and it wasn't unusual for Dennis to run into him in the morning, on the subway or out on the street. Strangers watching them in those days would have thought they were long-lost comrades in arms, a couple of ex-GIs, maybe brothers, who had not seen each other since before the invasion. Dennis would catch a glimpse of light off Billy's glasses and shove his way through the standing commuters in his car to shout, "Hey, Bill!" Or he'd hear his own name out on the street and turn to see Billy bobbing through the traffic, heading toward him. "How are you? How's things?" Shaking hands and slapping their fresh newspapers on each other's back.
"Good to see you."
It would take an act of will to picture him now as he was then, to put aside every image that had come in between, including that dark, stiffly bloated remnant of his face that was Billy in death, and remember him clearly. Thin and handsome in those days, the dipped brim of his fedora over the blue eyes and the rimless glasses, a nick of dried blood on his smooth cheek, a red blush from the cold. A lingering scent of the church he had just come from on his overcoat, and a taste of the Eucharist still on his breath as they stood together in the crowded subway car, hand over hand on the same white pole, exchanging shouted bits of news, or falling into silence as the train rattled and screeched and tried to knock them off their feet, as glad for each other's company as if they'd long been deprived of it.
"The way your brothers used to be," my father said.
In their teens and early 20s, when a buddy or two would come by the house and they'd all stand in the living room for a few minutes before they went out, grinning, knocking shoulders, laughing at everything, because the world that just moments before had seemed the source of only aggravation and concern had suddenly become easy and diverting, theirs for the taking.
"Pity the girls, I used to tell your mother when they'd gone."
Tires screeching out of the driveway and the furniture they had dwarfed beginning to crawl out of the corners again.
"Pity the poor girls,"
as my parents went back to their newspapers or Friday night TV shows and tried to keep the smell of the boys' aftershave in their nostrils because they could not, as they would have preferred, stand out in the street to look after the taillights.
"The girls," your mother would always say, "can take care of themselves."
The daily masses were a new thing with Billy, and tied up with Eva, no doubt, although the relatives thought it had something to do with the war. He would not have been the first in the neighborhood to have come back with a new need for religion, a new sense that only the daily formal petition for mercy would get them through the rest of their lives. But what Billy was asking for in those days was not mercy, or maybe it was mercy of another kind, the mercy of time. He needed time, weeks at work and bits of his salary tucked away and saved. But he needed to stop time as well. He needed the world to hold its breath for a while, for all affections, all hopes, all plans for the future to stop in their tracks for a while, to remain as they were all across the city, for all of us to be true to our own intentions. The church itself would have obliged. The good sound of the familiar Latin, the same women every morning saying their beads, the red sanctuary lamp, and the candles beneath the statues of the Virgin and Saint Joseph, steadfast and true. Even old Father Roach, an insomniac who said the 6 o'clock mass every morning because, Billy knew from his own days as an altar boy, he would be sound asleep in the sacristy by 8. Unchanging. And yet, from his sister Kate's bedroom at any hour of the night, there came her husband's hushed and angry voice, and more often than not, when Billy left for mass, she would be on the couch in the living room with Danny, her baby, in her arms. She would be crying softly. "Are you all right?" Billy would whisper awkwardly, embarrassed for her. She would wave him away. "I'm fine." The poor child, nearly 2 but wrapped like an infant against the drafts, wide-eyed, watching them both. On the drain board in the kitchen, shades of his father when he was alive, there would be a bottle of gin and an empty glass, his mother's antidote for a widow's long nights. After mass, on the platform at the Woodside Station, among the pressing crowd of strangers headed toward the train, Billy would hear his name called out and turn. Or walking toward the office, he'd see a hat on a head and above a pair of shoulders that he would recognize as Dennis's. They'd slap each other with their newspapers and grin madly at the not at all unlikely happenstance of meeting. "How are you? What's up? How's Mary? What do you hear from Eva?" "Eva's fine, had a letter on Tuesday." At last, and the first of the day, Eva's fine. Even the mention of her name, the shouting of it over the subway's roar, an act of courage, a reaffirmation of faith. These were the days when everyone they knew was getting married or having babies, when it was not unusual for the hat to be passed around the office 2 or 3 times a day, a big diamond glittering on the finger of the girl who handed out the card and the pen. "Is this for you?" Dennis would always kid her before he signed. "Come on, when is it going to be for you?" She was a pretty blonde, round-faced and small-mouthed, a great white smile that had a kind of bonus in it, the electric click of snapped gum. She was engaged to her high school sweetheart, who was still in the Navy. "What do you want to marry a sailor for?" he'd ask her as he signed his name to the card. "Who's going to be the sunshine girl when you leave?" She'd grin, snap, snap, and lean over to take the card and the pen from his hand. "I want to marry a sailor," she'd say, "so I'm not the sunshine girl when I'm 63. Claire Donovan was her name, from Brooklyn, via stenography. The fall and all through the winter and spring, they visited more churches and synagogues than Dennis could have imagined, following hand-printed maps or hastily copied instructions, riding the subway in good suits, or driving with Billy or Danny or Mike, or with his mother and Holtzman in the old car. Or crowded into a taxi with a group from the office, dry-mouthed and laughing over what they couldn't remember about the night before. There was always the smell of bay rum and Vitalis and Chanel. The hangover breaking up like dark ice in the fall sunlight or a bracing winter rain, or in the triumph of finding St. Charles Borromeo in Brooklyn, or Faith United Methodist in Hastings, or Bethel in Little Neck, Queens, with 20 minutes, time for a quick cup of coffee, to spare. And then the stepping inside, resisting the habit in the Protestant churches of reaching for the holy water font, although more often than not they blessed themselves anyway, the ushers in their morning suits smiling to see it. With a face like that, how could he do otherwise? And slipping the yarmulke on in the synagogues, self-conscious but game, the jokes in the Yiddish accent would come later. The point of the ceremony, of their gathering like this in their best clothes and their polished shoes, being everywhere the same. For Billy, it was sustenance. Even the churches and synagogues themselves provided sustenance. Crowded among apartment buildings or brownstones, sitting among trees or parking lots, appearing as you climbed up out of the subway or made the last of a dozen wrong turns through suburban streets, or flip the map upside down and look through the windshield to say, it should be here. The number and variety of them sustained him, the sense that in every town, up to the Bronx and out to Staten Island, and even far into New Jersey, the need for faith, for that which was steadfast and true, had given rise to these holy places, these cathedrals and sanctuaries and catering hall altars before which Grace from stenography might stand, or Jack from service, or Peggy Lynch, Uncle Mike's pretty daughter, or her sister Rosemary, who was not the pretty one, or Tommy from the neighborhood, or Cousin Ted, straight as an arrow in his morning suit, you had to hand it to him considering how comatose with drink he'd been the night before, stand and say, this will not change. On Sunday evenings, while Dennis was going into Manhattan to meet Mary, taking the subway when he had resolved to sin no more, Holtzman's car when just one more was the current resolution, Billy wrote to Eva, still in his suit pants and the clean shirt he'd worn to mass. His mother, God help her, she was a miserable cook, would be toughening up a roast in the oven and cooking the color out of Brussels sprouts and green beans, figuring that flavor was not inherent in the vegetables themselves, but acquired after long simmering when they were doused in their serving bowls with butter and salt. Rosie and Mac, her husband, would be at his mother's or the movies, Kate down to Uncle Ted's with the baby so her husband could study. Dear Eva, he would write, and no doubt he could have filled a page with it the way he loved to repeat her name. Hello, Eva. How are you, Eva? He told her how he spent his days, writing as well as he could, but being careful, too, he said, not to go on too long about ordinary things. He knew better than to say everything he felt. But he also knew that the listing of too many ordinary details was worse. To say what he felt would have been to stifle with one sentence a thousand others, but to say only what he'd done would be like describing a city that blocked out the sun. He must have thought of the girl in Metz, I am still here, because surely it was all he meant to write to Eva every Sunday as his mother put out her wedding china and Mac and Rosemary bustled in and Kate returned with the baby to timidly knock on her own bedroom door. As somewhere some church rang a distant bell and a bus spit exhaust on the boulevard and Mary took Dennis's arm as they crossed Park, headed toward Lexington and a bar and grill owned by an Irishman who'd been brought over by his father. As the water struck the sand that led to the great house on the hill that Billy and Eva would marvel at again, together, his idea of heaven, before returning to their idyll in Holtzman's little place. An idyll that would begin whenever the money he was putting away each week, which was increasing itself incrementally even now over at East River Savings, had grown sufficient enough to bring her back. Unwavering faith, this will not change. I am still here. But the money was slow in growing. There were all the wedding presents after all, the baby gifts and bachelor parties and the office collections and cab fares and cleaning bills. There was the money he gave Kate when she needed a lift after a night of the baby crying, and Peter, her scholar of a husband, shouting about the exam he had to take the next day, the studying he'd not yet done. There was the money he lent his cousin Ted when he smashed his car on Queens Boulevard so his new wife wouldn't know, and the money he gave his mother when she broke her bridge. There was the special collection for Father Roach's 50th year as a priest. You're more like my father than my father was, Dennis told him one night at Quinlan's when he was crying in his beer that he would not have the boat fare by summer, much as he tried. In this family, Billy said, his glass to his heart. You couldn't say a kinder word. Danny Lynch raised his own drink. Amen to that, he said, ever the keeper of the flame. In those days, Dennis had his territory on the Lower East Side, from Broadway to the river, Houston to Canal, shops full of Jewish and Chinese merchants, streets littered with bums. The bums would pull themselves out of doorways when they saw him coming, rise from the edges of curbs to say, "We're moving, officer, we're moving," as if any round-faced Irishman in a top coat and a hat had to be a cop. They'd salute like old soldiers, or hunch their shoulders and cower like serfs in the Middle Ages, like men who more than once had felt a nightstick crack upon their backs.
"We're moving, detective."
Dennis would raise a fist at them, touch his overcoat as if he indeed carried a pistol and a badge.
"You'd better move, fellas, and keep moving."
Drunks, bums, booze hounds, what you thought of in those days when someone said alcoholic. 4 steps down and into a dingy little shop that he'd remembered being closed up even before the war. The door propped open with flattened cardboard boxes, not for air, it was a cold gray day, but light, since the power hadn't been turned on. There was a narrow counter filled with haphazard piles of shirt boxes, another dozen or so large containers filling all but a thin passageway through the store. There was a barrel spilling straw, an odor of old damp brick and roach powder. He rapped on the counter and called out, and a man appeared from the back. A small, short man in a wool jacket that was too big for him, and a fur hat that was too small. His hands were bare and he held them together. They were bright white in the gray place, and he rubbed them together because it was cold, of course. But the effect, with his hooked nose and his stooped shoulders, made Dennis think Shylock.
"Edison,"
he said warily, because he knew this was a guy who would not take anything he said at face value. The man moved his head like a turtle, getting a better look at him in the gloom of the store.
"You the Edison man?"
Dennis put his hand out to introduce himself and saw that the man was missing the middle 3 fingers of his right hand and the tips of the last 3 on his left. He was a Polish Jew, not long in New York. A tailor, he said, before the war, and without indicating his hands gave a vaudevillian shrug. Now a shopkeeper, ladies and children's apparel. Or anyway, as soon as he had the power, he would be. As Dennis had predicted, the man didn't want to hear anything he said, and end of next week was too long for him to wait. He was not an old man, not as old as he'd first appeared, but he seemed shrunken inside his big coat, and he had a lousy set of dentures that slipped as he spoke and made his breath stale.
"Mr. Lynch,"
he said. Once he got hold of Dennis's name, he was like a dog with a bone.
"Consider my situation."
"Mr. Leibowitz," Dennis told him, "consider your wiring. Consider your shop going up in smoke."
The man pretended to be resigned. He looked around the place as if all his struggle, through the war, through the camps, through the long crossing over, had come to this cold, pathetic end. He shook his head, as if he was familiar with this mundane disappointment delivered by this mundane, earnest, broad-faced man, a disappointment as pervasive and as terrible as the world's more famous evils. He shrugged, and then suddenly turned and gently took Dennis's hand, holding his wrist in the space between his pinky and thumb on the left. He drilled a folded bill into Dennis's palm with his right.
"Anything you can do," Mr. Leibowitz said.
Dennis objected and tried to hand the money back, but the man turned away, waving his gaped hand behind his ear, swatting at the words. He might have said, "It can't hurt." The folded bill was still in his pocket when he got back to the office. He rode the elevator up with Claire Donovan and 3 other girls, just back from lunch, their fur collars smelling of perfume and cigarette smoke, their bright lipstick fresh, and the powder on their cheeks and noses like a dusting of sugar.
"You're quiet, Mr. Lynch,"
Claire Donovan said into his ear as they watched the lights moving behind the numbers for each floor.
"I'm praying for a power failure, Miss Donovan,"
he said, moving only his eyes to look at her, her bright white smile and the gum cracking like sparks behind it. Peppermint, sugar, lilac perfume. The war was far enough behind them now. Bread was bread once again, not cake. He had a hankering for cake. Billy got on at 12.
"Dennis,"
he said, and Dennis said, "Billy boy," as if he'd spent the morning looking for him. They nearly shook hands. But the eyes of the 4 women were on them, on Billy more accurately. He was the only one of them not wearing a hat and a coat, and it made him seem finer somehow in his gray suit and white shirt and simple tie. the way a priest all in black can seem the more elegant in the midst of brightly colored wedding guests.
You've been out in the field? Billy asked softly.
Till just now, Dennis said.
When they got to their floor, the girls stepped out, but Dennis pinched Billy's sleeve and made him stay on.
Who is he?
They heard before the door closed on them again, and Claire Donovan answered,
Cousins.
Dennis reached into his pocket and pulled out the folded bill. He was surprised to see it was a 10. He handed it to Billy.
Put this in your happily ever after fund.
Billy looked at it sheepishly. Where's it from? The elevator stopped and Dennis pushed another button for a higher floor. He told him. He said he was going to put it into the poor box at St. Bridget's, but the door was locked.
I think the bums have been coming in and stealing the communion wine.
Catholic bums, Billy said. Dennis nodded.
The worst kind. So take it and put it in your happily ever after fund.
Still, Billy hesitated. He told Dennis to put it in the collection basket on Sunday. Dennis said he'd have spent it by Sunday. Billy said spend it. Dennis said he had a rich mother, he didn't need to spend it. Finally, he pushed the money into Billy's palm as Mr. Leibowitz had done to him. He said when the time came, when Eva was back here and they were snug in their little cottage in East Hampton, Billy could buy all their baby clothes from Mr. Leibowitz.
Will it ever happen?
Billy said wistfully, even as he folded the money into his pocket.
Dennis said, I don't see why it shouldn't.
Although, in truth, he saw, indistinctly as yet, and as if from the corner of his eye. Think of those ruined, ragged men in the street, Billy among them, in the unimaginable future. Think of Leibowitz's butchered hands. Think of the promises he had made to Mary at moments when the girl had every right to believe him, when for as long as it took, he managed to believe himself. With so many other forces at work in the world, brutal, sly, deceiving, unstoppable forces, what could be more foolish than staking your life on an ephemeral feeling, no more than an idea, really, a fancy, the culmination of which is a clumsy bit of nakedness, a few minutes of animal grunting and bumping, a momentary obliteration of thought, of conscience. Indistinctly, and as if from the corner of his eye, he saw what Billy's fine dream, Billy's faith, was going to come to. But he also saw, in his own father's romantic heart, that its consummation would become a small redemption for them all. Holtzman's head was huge when you came upon him from behind, in the dim back corner of his shoe store, bent over his inventory sheets and fresh from the barber's, so the only way of telling where his neck stopped and his head began was the seemingly arbitrary place where a shadow of tiny hairs began to sprout from that Germanic column of red and purple flesh. The stockroom smelled of shoe leather and cardboard, and as Dennis came closer, dill pickles and mustard. The overhead lights were remarkably dim. The only brightness came from the single gooseneck lamp that sat on his desk. His sandwich in its wax paper nest rested on the corner of the desk, just outside the circle of light, and when Dennis saw Holtzman's fat hand reach for it and lift it to his mouth, he knew for certain that the man still hadn't heard him come in, and that if he cleared his throat and called Holtzman's name or came a few steps farther and touched his shoulder, he would startle the old kraut, perhaps send that plug of ham on rye with butter and mustard right into his esophagus. So Dennis paused, long enough to see Holtzman return the sandwich to the desk, long enough to see that it was chewed and swallowed. He turned an inventory sheet over and sighed and lifted a finger to his mouth to dislodge something from between cheek and gum. Long enough, too, to reconsider what he was doing and to turn around, get back on the train, get back to work. Let Billy's sweet romance follow its own course. But the road to hell. And Dennis said,
Excuse me, Mr. Holtzman. I'm sorry to interrupt.
The man turned, his big head like an old buffalo's, peering over his flank. And then, when he saw it was Dennis behind him, he swiveled his chair around and wiped his mouth and began to stand. Dennis held out a hand.
Don't get up,
he said, although Holtzman was already standing, already saying,
Dennis? And then, is everything all right?
The chubby hand to the heart lacking even the courage to let him say, is your mother all right? Dennis knew then that he'd had the right idea, coming here to him. Holtzman offered him the metal chair beside his desk.
Please, sit,
he said, after Dennis had assured him that his mother was fine, that he had only come to ask a favor. Even in that dim light, Dennis saw two things pass in quick succession over the man's face. One was the relief that there was no bad news. Second, the sudden suspicion that he was about to be asked for money. Which Dennis did, of course, and without too much beating around the bush. He said he wanted to borrow $500 to give to Billy so he could send for his girl and her mother by summer, find an apartment for them all, and get on with his life. He said Billy would be glad to work in the store on the weekend so that the money would be an advance against salary, not a flat-out loan, and that Billy and he would be sure all of it was paid back in a timely manner, with interest. He said he was certain that Billy would eventually save what he needed himself without anyone else's help, but it could take him another year, and a year was a long time for a young girl to wait all alone on the other side of the ocean.
You met her, Dennis said, last summer, on Long Island, outside St. Philomena's.
Holtzman nodded.
A pretty girl, he said, and already Dennis could see that he was forming an argument against him.
Prettiness was a virtue. She would wait for Billy to earn the money himself. Dennis nodded.
Pretty enough, he said, countering what he hadn't spoken. But for Billy, the moon and stars encircle her head. I don't know that he can wait.
Holtzman shrugged a little, touching thumb and forefinger to his chest. Dennis saw his eyes glance longingly at his thick sandwich.
Eat, please, he said. Don't let me stop you.
Eagerly, Holtzman took hold of the sandwich, sending, as he did, another longing glance toward his inventory sheet. Dennis began to wonder if he should have gone to his mother instead, but he'd been certain that his chances with Holtzman were better. The man had, after all, given up what had seemed a comfortable and complacent bachelorhood to take on a penniless wife and her grown son. He had opened his home to them, his cottage on Long Island. He had moved his ancestral furniture to the basement or distributed it to her relations in order to accommodate her second-hand junk. He had readjusted his morning routine, rewritten his will, instituted what was called a family discount at his store, which was essentially 20% off for anyone who was identified as part of Daniel Lynch's sprawling legacy, and increased his own grocery bill by at least 50%. He had complicated his life, all because a tiny woman had entered his shoe store looking for size fours, all because she had placed her stockinged foot in the palm of his hand. He had, according to Billy's mother, who was there, wept copiously, gratefully, as he recited his wedding vows in the dim front room of the rectory. Holtzman took another bite of sandwich, passed his tongue over his teeth, chewed, put the napkin to his thin lips. He never had managed to look Dennis straight in the eye. My mother's husband. Finally, he said,
I'm not a wealthy man.
Dennis nodded, murmuring like a priest. He understood that, he said.
I'm not made of money, he said.
Dennis understood that, too.
It's an awful lot of money,
he added while Dennis continued to nod.
I don't know that I have access to that much money myself.
Dennis pursed his lips sympathetically. He was always struck by the irony of it. His father's wealth, which was purely figurative, had always been boldly proclaimed. Holtzman's, a literal fact, was relentlessly denied.
The business is still recovering from the war years, he said. Long-time customers came in and told me that they wouldn't shop here anymore because of what went on in Europe. There was leather rationing, you know. I had these damn corduroy shoes to sell. I lost a lot of business.
He looked at the big sandwich in his hand, seemed to consider whether or not it